I begin this morning with a story from evolutionary psychologist Robert Wright about his first ever meditation retreat, which he called just about the most amazing experience of my life. He goes on, "I came away from that week feeling that I had found a new kind of happiness, deeper than the kind I'd always pursued. I also came away a better person. Just ask my wife. And neither of those things lasted. Just ask my wife." Meditation retreats are no picnic. You don't follow your bliss. You learn not to follow your bliss, to let your bliss follow you. And you learn this arduously. If at the end you feel like you're leaving Shangri-La, that's because the beginning felt like Guantanamo. We spent 5.5 hours a day sitting in meditation, 5.5 hours a day in walking meditation. By day 3, I was feeling achy, far from nirvana, and really, really sick of the place. I was sick of the bland vegetarian food, and I wasn't especially fond of all those Buddhists with all those self-satisfied looks on their faces, walking around serenely like they knew something I didn't know. Those first days, I thought I wasn't succeeding as a meditator. Now, as the two leaders of this retreat were known to point out, you're not supposed to think of succeeding at meditating, and you're not supposed to blame yourself for failing, and blah, blah, blah. Well, they were right. To succeed, I really did have to quit pursuing success and quit blaming myself for failing. And some other things had to go right. There was my moment of bonding with a lizard. I looked at this lizard and watched it react to stimuli, and I thought, I'm in the same boat as that lizard, born without asking to be born, trying to make sense of things, and far from getting the whole picture. Whether I had made major moral progress by learning to empathize with a lizard is open to debate. The more important part of my expanding circle of affinity involved people. At the beginning of the retreat, I had sized people up, making lots of little judgments on the basis of no good evidence. For instance, guy wearing Juilliard t-shirt and exhibiting mild symptoms of theatricality. Well, aren't we special? By the end of the retreat, I was less inclined toward judgment, especially the harsh kind. My various epiphanies may sound trite. All I can say is that there is a bigger philosophical picture that these snapshots are a part of, and that I had made some progress in apprehending it. Now, I am well familiar with the kind of meditation retreat Wright describes and some of his reactions, but I have to say that my very first response to his story is that he is such a whiner. At least he got to walk half the time. I have been on retreats where we sat for 10 hours a day, for 10 days, in a noble silence so profound we weren't supposed to even read or write. He thinks he had it rough. We spent, in these retreats, the first 3 days focusing on the sensation of breathing on the nose and upper lip. Breath is used because it is an autonomic bodily function that we do have some control over, and the upper lip because the nose is the gateway to the breath in and out. Now, we did this for 3 days, and on the third day, we finally took our keenly focused attention and scanned for all the bodily sensations in our physical bodies. But then we were also required to do a daily sitting of aditan, or great determination, when we were supposed to sit for 1 hour without moving a muscle or blinking an eye. So what is the point of all of such a grueling practice? I can still hear the teacher Goenka, who was from India, intoning the Pali word for change. Anicca, 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 changing, 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 exhorting us to notice the fundamental impermanence of all existence. The point of such focused attention is to help us observe rather than react. Such observation leads to one of the Buddha's fundamental realizations, that all things are always arising and passing away. The great law of impermanence, which leads to the first noble truth, that suffering arises because of our attachment to a phenomenal existence which is always changing. What pain there is in loving that which is ultimately mortal. Goenka's retreats were intense. I have also been to retreats that were more like the one Wright describes, and while difficult, they are less grueling. And he's a whiner. Yet the point is the same: to learn to breathe into and through distractions, to see the fundamental changing nature of existence and become less attached to any particular outcome. I just love the titles of Sylvia Bornstein's books on meditation. Pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. And don't just do something, sit there. If I were to write such a book, I would title it, Don't Scratch Where It Itches. Indeed, scratching every itch is part of what gets us into trouble. We rush to avoid pain, scratch where it itches, gratify every desire, and we live in a culture that tells us that that is the way we will find happiness. But happiness is an elusive quality, a constantly moving target. Indeed, it is another thing that is always arising and passing away. Besides, if I immediately scratch every itch that I feel, I would never know that most itches really do subside, and in pretty short order. For the pains and itchiness are also impermanent. Human suffering comes when we cling to pleasure and try to avoid pain. The first step toward liberation lies simply in noticing this cycle, this habit. And it's pretty hard to get away from during 10 hours of silent meditation every day, whether you get to walk or not. And boy, did I suffer at those retreats. At my first Goenka retreat, he was always telling us to be perfectly equanimous, perfectly equanimous. I spent the full 10 days thinking to myself, equanimous? Equanimous? That's not a word. That's not a word. A subsequent visit to the Oxford English Dictionary revealed that it is indeed a perfectly serviceable English word. At my second Goenka retreat, I figured out that if I sat 10 hours a day for 10 days, that made 100 hours. So each hour was 1% of the time. And I could count down. 1 hour done, 1%, only 99% to go. After we broke noble silence at the end of the retreat, I confessed my endurance strategy to the friend who had joined me on retreat, and he smiled and said, "Boy, are you good at suffering." He had simply given himself over to the rhythm of the retreat, an approach that never, ever occurred to me. There are many misconceptions about Buddhism and meditation. Neither is about achieving happiness, although greater happiness often comes with it. It is not about becoming beatifically calm in the face of life's vicissitudes, walking around with a self-satisfied look, unmoved and untouched. Although meditation is often accompanied by a greater calm. The goal of meditation is not to become so focused that the mind empties of all thought and judgment and the ego disappears. Although a certain spaciousness does often arise. Before Noble Silence fell at one retreat, I overheard someone say that her goal was to get high without drugs. It's not about that either. Certainly, all that can and probably does happen with some frequency. I am a happier and somewhat calmer person because of years of meditation practice. But any happiness and calmness is a side effect, not the main point. Ultimately, the goal of a Buddhist practice is to face the deepest realities of being human right now, in this moment, and again in this, and again in this moment. Really, that's it. Now, the Buddha had plenty to say about what happens when someone is able to remain that present to that level of reality. He had plenty to say about how to get there. He sat in heavy-duty meditation for years, and he came to a powerful understanding of the nature of reality, of being human, and the way to become free. After his enlightenment, he spent years teaching the path to such realization to all who would listen. Yet the core of his teaching is that simple. Be fully present, now, and now, and now. Wake up and stay awake. Yet the Buddha also did really say, believe nothing, no matter where you read it, or who said it, no matter if I have said it, unless it agrees with your own reason and your own common sense. Be ye lamps unto yourselves. In other words, don't take my word for it. Only believe what you experience as truth for yourself. And by the way, here's what I have learned, and here's the path I have discovered it. I have discovered. Try it. It can work for you too. Buddhism was the first gate on my spiritual and religious journey, and it led me pretty quickly to Unitarian Universalism, for the two have much in common. Buddhism is a humanistic faith in the sense that its primary concern is in this life, and it holds that salvation or liberation is possible in this life. Even though people and cultures have done plenty in conceiving Buddhist gods and heavens and hells, Gautama Buddha had almost nothing to say about God or an afterlife. And neither Buddhism nor Unitarian Universalism make any claim to be the one true path. Both encourage doubt and hold experience and reason as the touchstones of a true spiritual path. Buddhism appealed to both my mind and my heart through teachers, especially those at my first retreat, one very like the one that Robert Wright described. The teachers, most notably Jack Kornfield, were intelligent and funny and wonderfully kind. And I thought, I want that. They weren't self-satisfied and serene, spouting New Age truisms. They spoke clearly and kindly, but with force and passion. I love the story of the Buddha's awakening. Siddhartha Gautama had pursued enlightenment for many years on many paths, and finally he sat down under the Bodhi tree and determined he would not move until he had achieved enlightenment. The power of his determination, so the myth goes, awakened the demon Mara, who came and hurled every fear and every temptation he could think of. Think Jesus and the devil and 40 days in the desert. Nothing worked. Nothing perturbed or persuaded Siddhartha. Finally, Mara shouted at the seated figure, "Who do you think you are? What right do you think you have to enlightenment?" And at this point, the Buddha simply touched the ground and said, "I am a child of the earth. I need no other special power." And at that moment, the moment he touched the ground, the Buddha was enlightened. The Buddha didn't claim anything of himself that is not possible for any one of us. We all have Buddha nature, a deep well of goodness at the center of our being. We are all, you are all, potential Buddhas. And indeed, there have been many enlightened ones throughout human history. This spiritual realization is available to us all. And here's another liberating tidbit. Every single moment, especially those of the greatest presence and attention, are always pregnant with the possibility of enlightenment. There really is no such thing as failure. Each moment offers the chance to begin again. Sitting in meditation, focusing on the breath, the mind will wander for a few seconds or a few minutes. No worries. Just start again. Bring the attention back to the breath. Even if you're off again in 2 seconds, no worries. Start again. I can still hear Goenka intoning, "Start again, start again, start again with a calm and quiet mind, equanimous mind." Yes, there were several choice names that I had for him in my head whenever he said that, but I knew what he meant. Every moment is a chance to start again. Every moment is a chance to wake up, a moment to dance. Dance into and in freedom. Buddhism is not about becoming so detached from the joy and the pain of living as to no longer feel it. It really means actually waking up more fully, indeed feeling it all, and yet somehow holding it all more lightly. This kind of non-attachment, distinct from detachment, gives us the freedom to live more deeply, to love in the face of certain loss, and to bear the pain, yes, with equanimousness. And when we do this, we too can feel akin to the lizard, indeed, akin to all other beings who are born without asking to be born, trying to make sense of things and far from getting the whole picture. Now, this congregation is entering a time of great change. You are used to singing at the beginning of the service, "Don't be afraid of some change," although even that has changed. And yet it's a good reminder. The Buddha might also have said, "Don't be afraid of some change." Certainly, being fearful isn't going to make a difference. For as Jack Kornfield says, impermanence is the nature of the human condition, and we tend to resist this truth. Change happens all around us all the time, yet we long for the predictable, the consistent. Or as John put it in his insights from his own meditation practice, we want to shake hands with opportunity for spiritual growth or new relationships, yet at the same time, we are unwilling to let go with the handshake we have with the past. It serves us much better to learn to evolve and thrive in an ever-changing world. This is true all the time in our lives. And yet sometimes we are also graced with having this truth presented clearly before us. Everything arises and passes away, even ministers. Everything changes, even as we want to hold on to what is familiar. Now, this doesn't mean that you have to spend days and days creating beautiful sand mandalas, and then as soon as they are done, blowing them away, which is a pretty, pretty intense practice of experiencing impermanence. But it does mean that we need to let change happen, embrace it, not fear it, pay attention to it, let it become a spiritual practice for us. Because it is ultimately the only practice for us to be alive and human and know we will die is the beginning of spiritual practice. For it is a fearsome thing to love that which is mortal. And it is also a glorious thing to love that which is mortal. For it makes our lives more precious and real. It helps us live them more fully. Everything is always changing. Notice this truth in your lives, in the life of this congregation. Note that just the noticing is the first step toward freedom and liberation. Hold hands with the past, but cling not too tightly to it. For remember, we are all in the same boat all the time. Born without asking to be born, and trying to make sense of things, and far from getting the whole picture. This should help us arise in the world with greater compassion for the lizard on the path and for all we encounter in our lives. So the truth is, we might as well go with the flow. Let go the fear that arises as best we can. Hold things as lightly as we can, and hold hands with one another as we dance our way to freedom. Amen, and blessed be.